Hi, thank you, Jeremy. Thank you, everybody. It's lovely to, I live just up the road, so it's an enormous pleasure to be at the Duke of York's, kind of in front of the screen. It's very strange. And after a long day of fantastically interesting talks, there is nothing like some hardcore cognitive and computational neuroscience to ease you into the pub afterwards. So that's what we're going to do. And there will be, unfortunately, I feel very like, this is not really a laser pointer anymore, is it, after Seb's presentation. I want to start with a story about two philosophers, Ludwig Wittgenstein and Elizabeth Anscombe. And Elizabeth Anscombe was, one point in her career, was Wittgenstein's biographer. And there's a story that after breakfast one day, they were walking in the garden, and Wittgenstein just asked Elizabeth a question. He said, why, at one point, did people think it was logical to say that the sun rotated around the earth rather than the earth rotating on its axis to give us night and day? This is how Wittgenstein talks after breakfast. And Elizabeth Anscombe said, well, I guess because it seems as though the sun goes around the earth. Wittgenstein says, ah, but how would it seem if that seemed as if the earth rotated on its axis? Very Wittgenstein. And what he's trying to get at with this, I think, are two things. One thing is that how things seem is not how they are, right? Yes, it seems as though the sun goes around us. But as we know, as we've known since Copernicus, long before Wittgenstein, that's not true. It is, in fact, the earth that rotates on its axis. The earth is going around the sun. That's one thing, but I think the point he was driving at really was a bit deeper, which is that even when you know how things are, the earth rotating on its axis, things will still seem the same way. The sun still rises in the east and sets in the west, the same as always. So when we realize how things are, how things seem both changes and remains exactly the same. And I want you to try and hold on to that, because I think something very similar can be said about consciousness and our experience of the world and the experience of being a self. So let's start from the beginning. You open your eyes and the world just seems to pour itself directly into your mind. This is a street in Brighton, which you may know, which I don't live on, but it's very nice, wish I did. And it's full of objects and cars and skies and the I-360 there. It just seems as if the world is pouring itself directly into the mind through the transparent windows of your eyes and your ears and all your other senses, and no effort is required at all. It just happens. What could be more effortless than that? What could be more natural than that? And it also seems as if the self, yourself, is perched somewhere inside your skull doing the perceiving. This all seems terrifically obvious. There's a world out there. We sense it with our eyes and our ears and so on. It's the self that does the sensing, and we form these perceptions, these experiences of the world. That's maybe how things seem. But what I want to explain to you today, or try and convey the idea today, is that how things seem is not how they are, and that our perceptions of the world and of the self are both constructions. The self is not the thing that does the perceiving. The self is itself a kind of perception. In fact, both the world, as it appears to us, and the self are kinds of controlled hallucinations, brain-based best guesses that have been tuned by evolution, not for accuracy, not to paint the world in our minds as it actually is, but to give us a subjective world that is most useful for us, that is useful for the organism, that is our body, in the business of staying alive. So just think about the experience of color. And what could be simpler than that? And even color turns out to be very far from straightforward. This is the electromagnetic spectrum. Our eyes, the cells in our eyes, are only sensitive to roughly 3 wavelengths in this very, very wide spectrum. This is the visible spectrum. And even within that, we're only sensitive to, so even within that range, we're only sensitive to just 3 wavelengths. All of our visual lives unfold in this thin slice of reality. But even within that thin slice, what we experience is very different from what's actually there. There's one demonstration that I always like to show for this. Always a question whether it will work. We'll see. If you just focus your eyes on the black cross and try not to blink or move your eyes, And then just raise your hands if you see all the magenta patches disappear and a green patch appear. Okay, that's pretty much everybody. Now blink and move your eyes, and the green patch should disappear, right? How many people have seen this before, by the way? A few of you, quite a few of you, actually. It's called a lilac chaser. I think it's a fantastic demonstration of how our brains construct color. There is no green patch whatsoever. There's no green patch. There are three things going on here. One of them is called Troxler fading. This is an effect whereby if something is in the periphery of our vision and just has sort of fuzzy borders and doesn't change, it tends to fade from our conscious experience and get filled in by what's around it. A second thing is apparent motion. We're all familiar with this. It's how movies work and so on. If things change nearby each other, the brain infers movement between them. And the third thing that's happening is color opponency. When the brain is exposed to one color for a while and that disappears, because in this case of Troxler fading, it perceives the opposite. And the opposite in color space of magenta is green. There's actually a fourth thing going on here, which I think is the most fun thing about this, which is that colors, real colors don't exist anyway. They're just what the brain decides to do with mixtures of wavelengths. But magenta exists even less than other colors, because you make magenta in the case of a projector by mixing red and blue light together. And if you think back to the electromagnetic spectrum, you've got kind of red, green, blue. Green is in the middle. And so if the brain receives red and blue light at the same time, it's sort of expecting its green receptors to be activated too, but they're not because there's no green light. So what does it do? It has to make something up. So what it makes up is magenta. So magenta for the brain is not green. And so when you see the green there, what you're really seeing is not green. Okay. How to understand that garbled bit of nonsense and this demonstration and visual experience in general, there's one key idea, which is that your brain is a prediction machine. And that everything you experience out there in the world and in here in the self is a kind of prediction. Now, this is a very old idea. Back in philosophy, it goes right back at least as far as Plato and his allegory of the cave. So the idea that prisoners are chained to the wall of the cave, and all they see are shadows cast by firelight, and they take those shadows to be real because that's all they know. Now, if we update this allegory to the 21st century, or to the 20th century at least, we can take a different perspective. Now imagine being your brain. You are your own brain. There you are, you're locked inside this bony vault of a skull, trying to figure out what's out there in the world. Now all you've got to go on as a brain are these electrical signals that are transduced by the eyes and the ears, that are only indirectly related to what's out there in the world, whatever it is. So to figure out what's out there, the brain has to combine this ambiguous sensory information with its prior knowledge, its prior understanding, its pre-existing understanding of what's going on. And by combining the sensory information and this prior expectation about the way the world is, the brain settles on its best prediction, its best guess about what's there. And that's what we consciously see. We don't see light. We don't hear sound. What we experience is the brain's best guess of what caused the sensory signals that our brain encounters. One more example of this, just to drive it home. This you've probably seen, many, many more of you. How many people have seen this illusion? It's a pretty common one. Yeah, it's still not everybody. So this is called Adelson's checkerboard. Now, if you have a look at this, and you look at these two patches, A and B, they should look different shades of gray. Do they look different shades of gray? Yes, good. But they are, of course, not different shades of gray, they're exactly the same shade of gray. And I can show you this if I just put you another image there, and these gray bars line up, and you can see it's exactly the same shade of gray. Move it across, and you can see I'm not messing around with you. That one has exactly the same image. It's the same shade of gray, but take it away, and they look different again. So what's happening here? What's happening here is that your brain, whether you know it or not, has built into the circuits of the visual cortex the knowledge that objects under shadow appear darker than they are. And so we therefore see the patch to be as lighter than it really is. And our brains are not, our vision is not supposed to be a light meter. It's not designed to figure out exactly the composition of the light coming in. It wants to know what's out there in the world. One more final example, which shows just how quickly our brains can use new information to update its best guesses about the world. Now, if you haven't seen this before, it probably looks just like a bunch of patchy black and white splodges, right? But if I fill it in with color, you can see it's a picture of a butterfly. So I want you to look at that for a couple of seconds so that your brain has a chance to absorb it. I should have done one of those wipes. Sure. Really enters your mind. If I take it away, really I should leave it on for a while, but we haven't got too long. Hopefully you can still see now in this echoes and shadows of that picture of a butterfly. And what's really interesting here is that the information coming into your brain hasn't changed at all. All that's changed is your brain's expectation of the cause of that sensory information. And that changes what you consciously experience. Now, thinking this way turns on its head not only the intuitive way that we might think about vision as a process of reading out the world, but also this kind of classical scientific view of it too. This is the intuitive way in sort of neuroscience terms. This is the visual system of a monkey, and the general idea is that vision works by signals coming in from the world and being processed in sort of increasing levels of complexity as the signals percolate deeper and deeper into the brain. So early parts of the visual cortex deal with lines and edges and colors and so on, textures, and then deeper layers deal with objects and people and places and faces and monkey faces, because this is a monkey brain. But this idea of the brain as a prediction machine changes all of that. Instead of vision or conscious experience in general depending on the brain reading out sensory signals that come from the world, it depends just as much, if not more, on perceptual predictions that flow in the opposite direction, from the top down or from the inside out. So we don't passively perceive our worlds. We actively generate them all the time. So there's one of these, we're kind of used to saying that, you know, I'll believe it when I see it. But really, with this in mind, we should be saying the opposite, that I'll see it when I believe it, or when my brain believes something, I will see that thing. And what this means is that what we see will vary depending on what our brains believe is going on. And there's lots of everyday examples of this where what we can consciously experience departs from what's there. An example I think we've all been familiar with is when we see faces in things. Faces in clouds, faces in arrangements of windows. For brains, faces are very, very important things out there in the world. We're very social animals, 153 people or whatever it is that Robin Dunbar identified. We recognize people's faces extraordinarily well. So the brain is always projecting the idea of face out into the world, whether we realize it or not. And so we see faces in pieces of toast, in the windows, on a church. We see it everywhere. We at Sussex, a few years ago now, with my postdoc, Kesuke Suzuki, who's now in Japan, played around with us to develop what we called the hallucination machine. And what we did here was take a neural network that was very good at classifying objects and images, and we sort of ran it the other way around. This was an algorithm actually developed by Google. They called it Deep Dream, and we adapted it so that we took a panoramic video of Sussex campus. How many people know Sussex campus here? So you know that there's that square where Falmer House is and the Student Union is and all that. They have a market there on Tuesdays. So we sat up there, we took a panoramic video, and we processed every frame through this algorithm, which was just projecting the expectation of dog into the image. And then people would put a headset on and look around, and they would have this experience. It's much more immersive through the headset. And this is, I mean, it's kind of trippy, but what's really interesting for me is that it's a proof of concept that we can simulate unusual conscious experiences. We can begin to get at the mechanisms of what's happening when people have altered experiences. So is this a psychedelic experience? Not really, but somewhat like it somehow. What we're doing now is adapting this method to simulate what's happening when people have hallucinations in psychosis, in Parkinson's disease, in dementia, in Charles Bonnet syndrome, in other kinds of conditions to get at the basis of these things. But for now, there's a simple message from this, which is hallucination then, seeing things that other people don't, we can think of as a kind of uncontrolled perception, where our brain's best guesses lose their grip on what's out there in the world. And the flip side is the message that I started with, that perception in the here and now is a kind of controlled hallucination, a brain-based best guess where the brain's predictions are always and everywhere reined in by what's out there in the world. Now, the next part of the story is to understand that this doesn't apply only to our experiences of the world outside, but to the experience of being a self within that world. Again, the self is not, in my view, an essence, an immutable essence of your own personality that sits in your skull deciding what to do next. It's also a kind of perception. And there are many aspects of what it's like to be a self. It's not just one thing. You can think about the bodily self. An important aspect of being anyone is this experience of like, yeah, it's this body, this object in the universe is part of me, always goes around wherever I go. Then there's a perspectival self, the experience of seeing the world from a particular first-person point of view. The volitional self, the experience of being the cause of actions, of intending to do things, making things happen, what people typically associate with free will, whatever that is. And only then you have things like the narrative and the social self. So these are the aspects of self, the narrative self, the story that the brain tells itself, the memories of things that happened and plans for the future. This is when an identity, an I, a name comes into the game. And finally, the social self, the idea that the experience of being anyone is partly refracted through the minds of others. Part of what it is to be me is how I perceive others perceiving me. All of these things are perceptions, all of these things are real components of what it is to be a person in the world. Now, I'll just give you one example of how the self can also be thought of as a perception, and this is the embodied self, the idea of the part of the self being this object that is a body. There's a very famous demonstration of how the brain can be tricked about this. Okay, rubber hand illusion, how many people know about this one? Lots of people know about the rubber hand illusion, but I'm going to show the video anyway because it's very funny. So what happens here is that the guy in blue has a real hand he can't see, and a fake rubber hand is placed in front of him, stroked simultaneously by the experimenter, and that's how you test it. It's a lot of fun to test. Now, this shows that, you know, for this guy, he knows it's not his hand. I mean, he's not that fooled. But there is, how many people have tried it, just out of interest? Oh, a few, okay. I mean, when I do it, you can tell me afterwards, I know it's not my hand, obviously, but there's this kind of weird, uncanny feeling that somehow my brain has assimilated it as something part of my body, maybe. And the idea that's often told about this is that what we experience as being our body is a process of what neuroscientists call multisensory integration. The idea that the brain is putting together information from different senses to figure out what's going on. So in this rubber hand illusion, the blue guy's brain is seeing a hand, he's seeing the hand being touched, and he's feeling touch at the same time, because his real hand is being touched straight with the paintbrush too. So the brain says, oh yes, hand looks like a hand, roughly, feel touch, see touch, it's my hand. Now, the strange thing about this, that's the accepted story, but I wanted to kind of just telling you that we've been sort of railing against this accepted story at Sussex for a long time now with my colleague Peter Lush. And we did the world's largest rubber hand study just before lockdown, actually, and about 370 people did the rubber hand illusion, because it turns out people vary a lot in how they respond to it. Some people are really convinced, and other people don't feel much going on at all. And we wondered whether, in fact, what's driving the rubber hand study is how hypnotizable people are. Now, this is a word with lots of baggage, but it's a real thing. People vary reliably in how their experiences can be altered by suggestions they may not even be aware of as being suggestions. And if you think about the rubber hand study, you're getting a very strong suggestion that you should experience something, especially when somebody approaches it with a sharp knife or a fork. And this is exactly what we found. So first and only graph, I think, in the thing, that the degree of response to the rubber hand illusion correlates very strongly with hypnotizability. So there's something interesting going on here that we're looking into a lot now about what other aspects of our experience can be explained by this very reliable difference. It's not gullibility, it's nothing bad, but we just vary in how suggestible we are. One other thing we found is this. I think you might remember this. So this is this jumping pylon. So just to get a show of hands here again, how many people seem to hear something when the pylon hits the ground? Like a thudding sound of some sort? You're not? Yeah, a few of you, okay. Of course, there is no sound at all. There was a Twitter poll about this, and it sort of went viral, and I think reached something like 40,000 people, and about 60% of them said they heard something when they saw this. There's no sound at all, but again, it correlates very strongly with how hypnotizable people are. So even when we know what's going on, we can't prevent that from happening. Okay, but the experience of a body isn't just about what object is out there in the world. It's also this experience of being a living body, the emotions and moods and this sort of basic sense of being alive that we all have when we are alive. And this brings up another aspect of perception, which is often overlooked. We normally think about perception as relating to the outside world. But there's a whole different arena of perception which has to do with sensing and regulating the interior of the body. And we call this interoception. It's not introspection, it's not thinking about thinking, it's interoception, perceiving the inside of the body. Because from the brain's perspective, again, think about being your own brain, the body is also, it doesn't have direct access to it. It has to get information about it coming through the blood, coming through various nerves, and so on. It has to make its best guess about what's going on. So the same principle applies, at least this is what I think, that the brain is always making predictions about what's happening inside the body, updating those predictions with information that comes from the body, and what we experience as a result are things like emotions and moods and this sense of being alive. They're controlled hallucinations about the interior of the body. But there's an important difference, which is interoceptive predictions, these predictions about the interior of the body, they're not really about figuring out what's there, like where the heart or the kidneys are, but it's about controlling things. When you can predict something, you can control it very well because you know what it's going to do next. And in this view, predictions about the interior of the body are about controlling, regulating the body to keep it going, to keep it alive. And I think this explains kind of nicely why the experience of emotions, let's say, is different from a visual experience of a laser light show. Visual predictions that are about what's causing visual signals out there in the world, they underpin visual experience because the best explanations are things in terms of where they are, how far away they are, and so on. Are they coming towards me or not? But emotional experiences, bodily experiences, they're about controlling the body. So they have more to do with, like, are things going well or badly? And that's how we experience emotions, fundamentally. Like, things are either good or bad or likely to be good or bad in the future. Now, so this is a whole of my kind of theorizing about this in neuroscience takes this idea that we can actually explain every kind of conscious experience as a prediction of one sort or another. When we understand what the prediction is for and what it's doing, we can understand why these experiences feel the way they do to us. And there's one kind of interesting implication of all this that comes out, which is that all the mechanisms in our brain that support our experiences of the world, that generate these predictions, test them against reality in the body, ultimately, evolution and development, design them, build them, create them, tune them in the day-to-day with respect to keeping the body alive. These mechanisms of prediction go deep all the way down. And this means that consciousness, our experiences of the world, are very, very closely tied to our nature as living and breathing machines. It's not just getting the software right on some neural-based computer. We are living machines, and I think our conscious experience depends on us being alive in a way that's often underplayed by people who think we can upload ourselves to the cloud and other such transhumanist techno-babble nonsense. And this is quite, also, it's a departure from what some of our most influential philosophers once said. René Descartes, who created the hard problem in the first place by dividing mind and body, he said that without mind to direct their bodily movements, animals must be regarded as unthinking, unfeeling machines that move like clockwork. He called them beast machines. And in doing so, it's hard to know what was in his mind, because at his time it was very important to preserve this division between humans and other animals. And So for him, other animals, even though they were made of flesh and blood, they didn't have the kind of mind that gave them ethical or moral status. Now, I've come to think exactly the opposite. By understanding the nature of the way we build our experiences of the world in terms of these predictions, the brain is a prediction machine, it turns out that we perceive the world and ourselves with, through, and because of our living bodies, so that we are conscious beast machines, and that's a good thing. So just to summarize the sort of main thrust of this, and then I want to talk about something else very briefly. The brain is constantly generating these predictions about what's out there. This applies to the world outside, and it applies to the self within too. We're predicting the world outside, we're trying to figure out what's out there, predicting the self, trying to control and regulate it. And this explains why things feel the way they do. And just to bring that all the way back to Wittgenstein, it might still seem like we read out the world and the self is the thing that's doing the perceiving. But just as Wittgenstein said to Anscombe all those years ago, what would it seem like if it seemed as if the world and the self were just forms of brain-based prediction? I think it would change everything, but also leave everything exactly the same. So that's the story that I tell. I also tell that a little bit in the book. But what I want to do in my last 5 minutes or so is tell you about one of the implications of this and how one of those implications is playing out in another project that I've been involved with for the last couple of years. So the first implication is that, okay, if my experiences are sort of brain-based best guesses, then we do not see things as they are, as Anais Nin said in The Seduction of the Minotaur. We see them as we are. This is actually a very old quote that goes back to somewhere in the Talmud, I think. And we're all different. Just as we're all different on the outside, we're all different on the inside too, in terms of our brains, our minds. So we will all inhabit different subjective realities, even when we are in the same shared space, as we all are now. We're going to all have different experiences, even here and now. And there's a concept here which I've sort of thinking about a lot lately, called perceptual diversity. So we're used to valuing now the externally visible diversity that we have in gender and skin color and sorts of things. And when we talk about diversity on the inside, there's a concept called neurodiversity, which has been, I think, very valuable to think of differences as not deficits, but it's typically applied to nameable conditions like autism or ADHD or something like that. What I think that overlooks is the possibility, in fact, I think the reality that we all are different. There is no normative, single, objective way we should perceive. We're all going to be different, but most of the time, these differences on the inside are subtle, that they don't actually surface into our reality. If we both look at a blue sky, we're both going to say it's blue, and we're not going to ever know that we might have a different experience of that blue. And this brings me to Dream Machine, so I'm just going to take 5 minutes to talk about this new project, which I think exemplifies this concept. This is a project that is part of this Unboxed Festival, which has been unfolding with varying degrees of public notice and success in the last year or so. It's funded a few large-scale kind of art science projects, and I got involved in one of them called Dream Machine. And it was in London. It's still running in Edinburgh, by the way, if anyone is going to Edinburgh in the next couple of weeks. But Dream Machine is based on a very old idea from the artist Brian Gyson. This is him with William Burroughs in 1972. And Gyson, in the 50s, he was on a bus trip, and he was going to Marseille, and it was late afternoon. The sun was beginning to set, and it was shining through some trees, and the light would start to flicker. So there's a bit of a metaphorical strobe warning here. No actual strobes, but I will talk about them. And Gyson had his eyes closed, and what he found was that as he was sitting there, he started to have these incredible experiences of color and shape and pattern unfolding within his mind. And he wanted to recreate this in a more controlled way. And so with Burroughs on side and a mathematician at Cambridge called Ian Somerville, built the first Dream Machine, which was just it was a cardboard cylinder with slots cut in it that would rotate, and you put a bright light in the middle. You sat in front of it, close your eyes, and you had these visual experiences, colors, shapes, and so on. Very vivid, very unusual. In neuroscience, I knew about this from a different trajectory. William Gray Walter, a pioneering British neuroscientist, had been playing around with stroboscopic light too. And there's a chapter in his 1953 book called The Living Brain, called Revelation by Flicker, which talks all about this effect and what happens in the brain when people are exposed to this kind of flickering light with their eyes closed. And about 10 years ago in my lab, we started to do some work on this. And this is me in the lab with our strobe there, having visual hallucinations, and sometimes, but not in this image, wired up to EEG and so on and so on. And so we're trying to find out what's happening in the brain that gives rise to this effect. But then, skipping over all the science stuff, this led to, 10 years later, getting involved in this Dream Machine project, which was a collaboration between scientists, there's me, philosophers, musicians, composers, that's John Hopkins there, architects, this Assemble Collective, who won a Turner Prize for some of their work, and technologist Dev Joshi over there doing something with his hands. And we wanted to build a dream machine for the 21st century and make it a collective experience that many people did together. This is what we eventually built. This is one image from inside the dream machine. People lied back in their own space, and they have a blanket and so on, and they close their eyes, and there's a guided kind of 30-minute stroboscopic journey that they all take individually and together. Do I have 3-4 more minutes to continue, Jeremy? Thank you. So I just wanted to give you a little bit of background for this, because I think for this audience it might be interesting. This is a short 2-minute just explainer from some of the people on the team about what it was we were doing. One of the great joys of the Dream Machine project is that the scientific and the philosophical aspects have been built in from the very beginning. We're investigating a phenomenon that's still not widely understood, how flickering light generates this kaleidoscopic, vivid, immersive range of experiences for people.
So we're really making something that is internal and quite transcendental and personal into a collective experience. Because of the nature of the experience, we're hoping that what will really happen is that it will engender conversation. And so every stage of the Dream Machine has been designed in a way to really enable people to talk to each other.
This particular project is unlike anything because your eyes are closed and your brain is creating the visual. It's the first time I've actually composed something specifically to be played in a 360-dimensional sound. So that's allowed me to do much more than I've ever done. There are more sounds in there than I would put in a stereo track. So it's a little bit like moving from black and white to colour.
Being inside this thing is kind of magic. It completely sort of envelops you. It saw the entire universe go by behind my own closed eyes.
I saw colours that I haven't seen for years. Vibrant, powerful, passionate colours. It was just absolutely, I found the whole experience absolutely fascinating.
I'd recommend it to anyone. And regardless of their age, because they could get the same feeling.
Our brains are powerful. They are very powerful things. I would consider it a life-changing thing to go through, 100%.
So did anybody get to see this? It was in London. I know a couple of you did. Oh, a few of you, brilliant. I'd love to have a chat afterwards about how you found it. We've launched in May, and we've been in London, in Cardiff, in Belfast, and still in Edinburgh. And by now, I think about 28,000 people have been through, which is quite a lot for something like this. And this is just one of the venues. This is in a deconsecrated church in Belfast, just on the border between West and East Belfast, which is, I think, the most beautiful venue. That's the Dream Machine from the outside, this kind of weird sci-fi-like blue structure that turns up in these different places. In Edinburgh, we're in Murrayfield Ice Rink, which is it's got this weird Stranger Things vibe there. I think it's much more spacious, but here, this gives a sense of how much the architecture changes the experience, so it's sort of guiding people on their way in with places to sit and so on. And one of the things we're doing, we haven't even started looking at the data yet, but everyone who goes in can come out, they can draw what they experienced. They can also use these specially designed tablets to go through a guided reflection of what they experienced, because everybody has a different experience in there. And at the moment, we don't know very much about that variety or what explains it. Why do some people see colors and shapes, and other people, they see people? Some people see their like long-dead relatives in the Dream Machine, which has been quite moving. Most people like to draw, though. We have these tables outside, and people can take crayons and pastels and draw what they experienced. And we're collecting these drawings now. We've got about 10,000-12,000 of them. And again, we want to look at what kinds of patterns emerge. This is just an example of a few of them. I think that they're quite, some of them, these, I don't know whether you call these beautiful, but some of them really are very beautiful. And so these are some of the reflections that people go from people who went through it. If you put these machines in churches or temples, I'd go every week. It was truly profound, truly enlightening, and many other testimonials like this. I think the most moving testimonials for me were a group that came through who were visually impaired. Some of them were registered blind. So they don't normally get to go to things which are primarily visual in their nature. And B, it still worked, because most people who are visually impaired or even blind still have some residual sensitivity in their eyes. So that's enough. So some of the testimonies from these people were like, they saw things that they hadn't seen for decades. And it was very, very powerful for them. And I'll finish with this call to action, really. Another part of the Dream Machine program is this thing that at Sussex, we're leading this project called the Perception Census. And this is back to the idea that it's not just in the Dream Machine that people have different experiences. We all do, everywhere and all the time, but not much is known about this hidden terrain of perceptual inner diversity. So I'm really trying to get as many people as possible to join us in this project called the Perception Census. There's a video, but I won't play it.
We'd love you to join us in the next.
It's just an explain animation, but I've explained it. But basically, it's an online thing. You can do it at home. All you need is a computer. And there are just 10 different sections on things like on color and how our expectations shape our perception, on sound and music. And if you're willing to give it a go, there's designed to be fun and engaging and as different from going into a psychology lab as possible. It would be great to get more input onto how we all experience a unique world. I'll hopefully leave a bunch of flyers about this outside. We're still rolling it out. We've rolled out two-thirds of it. The final third rolls out in a couple of weeks. You can just search for Perception Census online. So I think I am out of time now. I'll finish there. I can't avoid plugging the book, I'm afraid. This book came out last year, but it's just come out in paperback now. So if you'd like to read more about these things, you can read the book, in fact. And if you would like to start doing that very soon, I have brought a few copies with me, which I'll be illicitly flogging somewhere in the lobby as everybody leaves. So very welcome to pick up a copy there. But thank you very much.